man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
All right, welcome back to Who Shot Ya? If you can't tell, I'm not Iffy Wadaway. This is Drea Clark. I'm going to be taking on hosting duties this evening. And I am joined by my favorite bearded gentleman, film reviews editor at The Wrap, Alonzo Duralde. What is good?
Oh, Drea, so much is good. I just got back from Christmas Con in New Jersey, and it was just, you know, everything I wanted it to be. It was a delight. I met some wonderful people, got to hang out with some friends and make some new ones, did some really fun panels. The women who write these movies will tell you things. It was, I'm serious, you missed some good stuff. But I'll tell you what's good. A thing that I was not, like, excited about, I was not marketing it on my calendar, I wasn't even thinking that I was going to be watching it at all or interested, but the first episode of The Mandalorian is really good.
I gasp. I'm excited you watched that.
Well, I mean, it's like, it's for another podcast. They kind of forced me. But I'm like, my joke was that it's Bounty Law in space, you know, the fake show that Leonardo DiCaprio does in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It is your classic, like, bounty hunter and, you know, like, lawless land and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, with, you know, laser guns or whatever. But it's like, you know, you've got Nick Nolte and Carl Weathers and Werner Herzog and, you know, this amazing roundup of character actors. And it's got a sense of humor. And it's just, I was shocked at how entertained I was by it. And I'm sure I missed a million Easter eggs that my friends who live and breathe Star Wars were like, oh, that's the thing with the in the place and the time where they did the,
of course,
whatever. But I really enjoyed it.
How much of Pedro Pascal's beautiful face do you see?
None.
None. See, that is why I was like, I haven't gotten Disney Plus yet, and I probably would have if I thought I was going to see more of Pedro Pascal's actual beautiful face.
Yeah, he's wearing one of those Boba Fett type
helmets. Yep, that's what I figured.
Oh, and best part, a character mentions Life Day from the Star Wars Holiday Special, which means it's now canonical.
Oh, God.
Suck it,
I'm glad
George Lucas.
You made both of those things fit the Christmas theme of your
Absolutely.
Life. And we are joined by a very special guest today, a buddy of mine and TV writer for shows Vampire Diaries and the upcoming The Witcher, Matthew D'Ambrosio.
Hello.
What is good?
What is good is Lindy West, The Witches are coming.
Hooray.
Which is, I'm in the middle of it right now and I'm loving it.
Oh my
God.
It's
a good book.
Did you read Shrill as well?
I did not, but I've seen the show.
Okay.
Yes.
Lindy West, also, she's an incredible writer, and you should check her out. And she famously came into the, like, pop culture sphere with this incredible review of Sex and the City 2 for The Stranger, I think, in Seattle, that please Google it if you haven't already. So you're halfway into her new book.
Yes, and I love it.
And is it about actual witches?
It's a series of essays kind of about the current climate that we're in.
Okay.
And about how, you know, witch hunt has been misappropriated,
right,
but she's taken it back and the witches are coming.
Yeah. Misappropriated and also by people who don't understand that they keep saying witch hunt where there's actual witches involved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You can't say that when you're standing by a cauldron. By the way, just to keep on theme, her review of Love Actually is also
Oh, that's true.
Brilliant.
Oh, you worked that in. I mean, this is why.
That's,
this is why you're the guy.
This is, I'm the guy.
Yeah.
Drea, what's good?
Oh, thanks, Alonzo. So my good what's for me is perennial, and I'm bringing it up because Matt is here. My cats are so good.
Love them.
I had three previous babies for almost 20 years, and I was devastated when I lost them. I've had these two sweet idiots for 3 years now, which is crazy. Peck, Shy, loves me the most, and actually I'm the only thing she loves in the whole world. And then there's Trillian, who's the most affectionate, flirtatious cat who absolutely fell in love with the boy next door, and that boy is Matt D'Ambrosio sitting next to me.
Every day I would go to get my mail, and she would just be waiting outside meowing at me.
She could hear if it was his door opening and would run to the living room that overlooked the courtyard. And she truly thinks she can speak English.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she talks to him, and she's devastated because he's now moved.
She's my cat girlfriend.
Yeah. And so it's a real thrill that the love of my cat's life has joined us today. So my cat's good forever and always. All right. Today, we are going to be talking about Last Christmas, and man, there is a lot to talk about.
So much to unpack.
Yes. We also have a call from the Who Shot Line. We have the magical Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. A thrill. I look forward to it every week. And then we're going to end with staff picks. But before we get into all of that, it is time for our news segment called It a Dick, which I can now say almost without blushing. It is short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the questions. Is this important? Do I care? So we're going to start with a little Star Wars. You've already sort of like, you did a little preamble.
Yeah, kind of primed the pump there.
In, yeah. For anyone who is not a Star Wars fan, there is a scene in Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, called, sort of subtitled, The Han Shot First Scene. And it is a very controversial element for the history of it. It takes place in the Mos Eisley Cantina with Harrison Ford's character, Han Solo, shooting dead the bounty hunter Greedo. Now, in the original 1977 cut, Han Solo is held at gunpoint by Greedo, and Solo shoots first, killing Greedo. And then 20 years later, when they did the theatrical re-release, the scene was edited to have Greedo shoot first, which kind of changes up Han's complicity in it. And therefore, Solo kills the bounty hunter in self-defense. And then in 2004, edited yet again to have the two characters shoot at roughly the same time. And just this past week, the film was made available on the recently launched Disney Plus streaming service. With it, a new cut. This time, the two characters shoot at around the same time, but a line was added to the film, and Greedo says the unsubtitled alien word, McClunky. An incredible, just a magical new language.
Shapoopy.
Yes. McClunky. Covfefe. Yeah. We have a clip of the word in question.
McClunky.
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 Okay. McClunky.
Every time I say it, I feel like I'm on like a spelling bee where it's like, could you say the word again?
Use McClunky. It in a sentence?
Yeah. Yes. Origin of the word? Huttese?
McClunky, say it soft and low.
Is this important? Do you care? And what does McClunky mean to you?
Oh, God. I wish, I'll tell you, because I'm a press person, I'm getting The Mandalorian. I'm getting links sent to me. I have not subscribed to Disney Plus, nor do I think I'm necessarily going to. But a thing that would have been a selling point for me if they had tried to pitch it this way would be if they had offered the 1977 edit of Star Wars and the 1980 edit of Jedi, like of Empire, like all of the pre-mucked about with versions of the George Lucas films. Because he's like Richard Carpenter. He cannot leave well enough alone. He's always going back and tweaking and changing, and it's never... It's just like, let us have the OG, you know?
I think the thing that gets me about it is that in my life, I have seen so many versions of this one scene, and it drives me crazy because I just want to see the original one again.
Yeah.
So is the original one only available if you... Are you able to get the physical copy?
If you have the 77 version,
is that still available to purchase?
No, but like enough people had it on Laserdisc that it's been digitized.
Sure,
it's floating around. You probably know someone who can get it in your hands. It's not a problem.
You'd be my first call for that.
It's like finding. Yeah, and I know somebody who could. So right. You know, you're one degree. It's like the Star Wars Holiday Special. No one's supposed to be able to have it. We've all seen it.
Everyone's seen it. Yeah.
But it is ridiculous that the original film is as hard to get as the Holiday Special that they tried to push themselves away from.
I am reminded of a story when I interviewed William Friedkin years ago. He made a movie called Rampage that didn't get released in the United States, starred Michael Biehn. It opened in Japan, but for some tie-up reason, it didn't play in the United States. And then several years later, he finally did get a U.S. release. And by that point, he had kind of a change of heart about what the movie was even about. And so he re-edited it extensively. And I think it went from being like, and don't at me if I'm wrong about this because I don't remember the details.
At him.
I think he changed it from like a pro-gun control movie to an anti-gun control movie or a pro-death penalty movie an anti-death penalty movie to a pro-death penalty movie. I forget. Something like that. He completely changed the politics of what the whole movie was about. And he cited an example of there was a legendary painter who was apparently one of the few living artists who had a painting in the Louvre. And he was constantly getting thrown out because the security guards would catch him in there with a paint and brushes, always trying to fix it, always trying to change it, always trying to, like, you know, make it perfect. And so I think sometimes filmmakers just don't know when to walk away from the painting.
I don't know if any artist does. And so it is like it's initially, it was George Lucas's creation, and he's the one behind the tinkering. And when does the ownership of something change from, no, man, that's ours now.
When, like, Disney buys it?
Well, one would think. According to The Verge, Lucas himself made the change to this scene before Disney bought Lucasfilm lock, stock, and barrel. So
he's just, that truly means he's just sitting around tinkering with it constantly.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, until somebody comes around with an idea for a Radioland Murders TV show, like, you know, why not? Actor Christian Bale has transformed his body for a lot of roles. He lost a bunch of weight for The Machinist, gained a bunch of weight for Vice, got all jacked up for the Batman movies. But according to a recent interview with CBS Sunday Morning, he is donezo with the transformation of his body. When asked about it, he said, "I keep saying I'm done with it. I really think I'm done with it. Yeah." He also told the Sunday Times back in January, "I can't keep doing it. I really can't. My mortality is staring me in the face." Is this important? Do you care?
I think that this is going to be important when we get to rub it in his face when he plays Harvey Weinstein in a handful of years and is, like, excited to do that.
Yeah, but even that, like, depending on how long the role goes, like, he'd have to go from, like, hefty Harvey Weinstein to, like, vegan Harvey Weinstein.
He's an artist, man.
Right, I know.
He can do the range of Weinstein.
It's a lot of demands for one shoot, is all I'm saying, physically.
Yeah.
As somebody who can't lose 5 pounds with a gun pointed at him, like, I can't even begin to relate with this conversation.
Yeah.
But, you know, I get it. I think that this is a young man's game to, like, starve yourself and then put on an extra 150 pounds and then lose it again. Like, at some point, your metabolism and everything else is like, no.
And it must get more difficult every year.
Sure.
And especially if you look at the, you know, he was in his 30s something when he was super pumped as Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Like, is it harder? I'm like, yeah, I could play Dick Cheney, no problem.
But, like, most among us could not.
Right? Like, yeah, that's a softball. But, like, it's the really, really skinny or the really buff ones that seem... It's just exhausting. And I wonder, too, as an actor... what it changes of when you're younger and you're like, no, I need to get into the embody this role. I really need to.
I can't just put on the shoes. I have to be in the body.
To be, and now you're like, no, I'm a professional. I'm fine. Just
well, it's kind of like doing your own stunts. Like, you have someone else do that for you because you don't want to get yourself hurt. But it's like, do you really have to put on the weight to play Dick Cheney?
It's like Olivier said to Dustin Hoffman, why not try acting? It's so much easier.
I also think of Marlon Brando when this story came up of when he was in Apocalypse Now.
Mm.
And they were like, all right, you are this probably emaciated colonel and you're in the jungle. You've been living on, like, rodents and leaves. And he's like, excellent. I will be 300 pounds. I will be bald. You will shoot me. In
amazing performance.
Yes. So, make each moment your own,
there
I guess.
You go.
Stephen King famously hated Stanley Kubrick's version of The Shining, and as some of you know, Mike Flanagan has directed a sequel to that film starring Ewan McGregor as the adult Danny Torrance called Dr. Sleep. That movie is also based on a Stephen King book. In a recent interview with Entertainment Weekly, he had this to say about the sequel film. I read the script to this one very, very carefully because obviously I wanted to do a good job with the sequel because people knew the book The Shining, and I thought, I don't want to screw this up. Mike Flanagan.
I like that.
Mike Flanagan, I've enjoyed all his movies, and I've worked with him before on Gerald's Game. So I read the script very, very carefully, and I said to myself, everything that I ever disliked about the Kubrick version of The Shining is redeemed for me here. Is this important? Do you care?
I really wish Stephen King would shut up about the movie of The Shining.
Honestly, I don't think I'd ever heard that.
Like, oh, he's been complaining about this for decades.
I'm really good at ignoring men complaining.
Well done. Like, it's like, dude, there have been, like, how many dozen movies based on your book.
Most terribly made.
Yes. Yeah. Many of them suck, including the one you directed, sir.
Listen, they can't all be Dreamcatcher.
Exactly. You know, but did you see Maximum Overdrive?
No.
I've only heard awful things about it.
Oh, man.
Maximum Overdrive, isn't that the name of the movie series that Matt LeBlanc stars in the Charlie's Angels franchise?
It should be. No, this was an actual film with the score by AC/DC.
Oh my God.
It's about trucks that come to life. It's so bad. Anyway, but he's been bitching about The Shining for forever now. And it's like, dude, you have all the money in the world. You get to publish anything you want. Everything you've ever farted out into the universe has been turned into a film or television show at this point. Let this one go. Let Stanley Kubrick and his fans like have this, you know.
Is there an element of artistic jealousy there?
I was just thinking, is it like, is he professionally upset that the movie overshined the book to some people?
I'm sure there are. He probably read like one review by like some British academic who referred to it as like, you know, Kubrick making high art out of pulp trash or something, and he's just still mad about it.
So did either of you see Dr. Sleep?
I have not seen it yet.
Okay. Because I also was slight, I haven't read it either. And it is interesting to me, the idea that Dr. Sleep, is it considered, it's an unofficial sequel.
No, it's a sequel.
It's an official sequel.
He wrote a novel that is a sequel to his novel, The Shining. And then apparently the movie tries to sort of split the difference.
That's what I meant. That's what I was wondering about. Sorry, that the movie incorporates elements both from the book and from the film.
From some people that I've talked to, I've heard a mixed response. Some people love this movie, some people hate it. But the ones who hate it have said that the movie is sort of struggling to be to do the book, but also to be a follow-up to the Kubrick movie, because that's what more people, or at least more filmgoers, are probably familiar with, you know. And so, like, you know, they go to the Overlook Hotel, even though in the book it burns down. Here it's still intact, and you know, they go through all these sort of recreations of the Kubrick sets. And my immediate thought is, I already saw Ready Player One. I don't need to revisit the Shining sets again. Thank you very much.
That's right. Yeah, I'm kind of interested to see this, largely because I really enjoy Ewan McGregor and the idea of
him playing. And Rebecca Ferguson is supposed to be amazing in it.
I hear she's good.
She's so good in everything. Mm-hmm. And she's the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
And I like Mike Flanagan a lot. I liked House on Haunted Hill.
Oh, okay.
I liked the Ouija sequel.
Yeah.
I like Gerald's Game, so we're all big.
Woo, look at this!
Flanny heads in here. All right, so I guess that's super important when we really care. all right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Last Christmas, just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hello there, ghouls and gals. It is I, April Wolf. I'm here to take you through the twisty, scary, heart-pounding world of genre cinema on the exhilarating program known as Switchblade Sisters. The concept is simple. I invite a female filmmaker on each week, and we discuss their favorite genre film. Listen in closely to hear past guests like The Babadook director, Jennifer Kent, Winter's Bone director, Deborah Granick, and so many others every Thursday on MaximumFun.org. Tune in if you dare.
It's actually a very thought-provoking show that deeply explores the craft and philosophy behind the filmmaking process while also examining film through the lens of the female gaze. So, like, you should listen.
Switchblade Sisters.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya. I am your host today, Drea Clark. In the studio with me are
Matthew D'Ambrosio,
Alonzo Duralde.
And today we are talking about soon-to-be American classic, watched in every household on every channel this time of year, Last Christmas. Matt, since you're our guest and I enjoy torturing you, could you please give us a quick synopsis?
So Emilia Clarke plays Kate, who finds a way to...
I believe her name is Katerina.
She finds a way to heal her broken heart when she has a chance encounter with Henry Golding at the most lovely time of the year.
Ooh.
Wow.
That was like a poster-worthy logline. The most magical time of the year, right after Alonzo's heart. So we actually had a lot of discussions before this movie came out about what it was going to be about. And some of those involved some kind of guessing at spoilers. Some were just involved of what do we think the story is going to be. So we are going to get into some spoilers later in the conversation. But to get us started, I'd love to hear from you guys based on the marketing for this and the knowledge of the team behind it. Like knowing that it's Paul Feig, knowing that it's Emma Thompson, whom I adore as a performer,
and as a writer,
and as a person who in this movie got to say my favorite line, and if there was an Oscar for best line delivery, it would be, "All of my friends are murdered."
Yes, that's the biggest laugh of the film.
Which is something in and of itself.
Yeah.
So I would love to talk about what were you expecting from Last Christmas?
Well, yeah, I mean, exactly what you said. I think Paul Feig, Emma Thompson, Christmas movie, you hear those two are collaborating, and it's like, oh, okay, well, this is going to be really smart and unique. And, you know, I always have to give a shout out to Paul Feig has directed a Christmas movie before, the 2006 comedy Unaccompanied Minors, which I'm a fan of, about a bunch of kids, children of divorce who are stuck in an airport during a snowstorm, who are all traveling from one parent to another on Christmas, and they are saddled together as unaccompanied minors.
It's a great premise.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. I liked it a lot. But yeah, my joke has been, except for the Almodovar movie, this is the film I was most excited about this year, you know, because, you know, the theatrical Christmas movie is not what it used to be. Like, there's so much going on television now that, you know, they've had to kind of find what's not happening on TV. So that's why we've been getting lately the influx of the R-rated Christmas movie, whether it's a dark comedy or a horror film or whatever, or the predominantly black cast Christmas movie. Because from like Hallmark and Lifetime stuff, we weren't necessarily getting that. Although this year, OWN is doing three themselves, so like everybody's getting in on this action. But anyway, yeah. So I was psyched that it existed. I loved the people involved. You know, Henry Golding just came off of another Paul Feig film, A Simple Favor, that I liked so much.
Can we pause for a small moment to the dreamy beauty that is Henry Golding?
So handsome.
Cary Grant in this.
I was gasping. I was like, there's no bad angle on this man's face. Even he's got like this perfect like askew tooth. It's like the little detail you'd give to make him look human.
The flaw in the diamond.
Oh yeah. My God. Anyway, stunning.
He's a smooth operator for sure. So yeah, so I had high hopes and I would say they were not met.
Matt, what about you?
Along the same veins, coming off of A Simple Favor, I was expecting a subverted Christmas movie, something funny, something dark. I agree with Alonzo. I did not get what I wanted.
I was going to say, but on the same token, I think like what I said in my review for The Wrap is like, it's sort of how like, unless you are Bing Crosby or Mariah Carey, if you're a singer, your Christmas album is not necessarily your best work.
Sure.
But it is something that the fans will turn to at that time of year because they want specific things out of it. And so this is sort of Paul Feig's Christmas album.
Yeah. What I found interesting was, because as I mentioned, I think Emma Thompson's a fantastic writer as well. Mm-hmm. And she has a crispness normally to what she's doing. And there's something about that that interjection of heart that's so necessary in holiday movies that I don't think fully jived with her style.
Mm-hmm. And there are great Christmas movies that are very kind of crisp and and unsentimental. And I think she could have leaned into that. But of course, she had talked to George Michael about doing a jukebox musical of his material before he died. And he signed off on it, and it eventually became this film. So I don't know if it's the having to work the George Michael stuff in, the tonal quality of the George Michael stuff that bleeds into how the movie presents this stuff. But yeah, it doesn't have the kind of, this doesn't have the sort of like dry precision of like the diary that she published for Making Sense and Sensibility.
I read that. Yeah. There's something to me, I think, is one of the fundamental problems with this. There's a messiness to it that I was not expecting.
And there were so many parts of the movie that I thought worked well, and there was a nugget of something that I really liked in it that just didn't come together out of it.
Mm.
Right. Like ultimately it's her story. It's sort of a romance, but it's her story. And that's, I think, part of the kind of cognitive dissonance of what's going on of, am I following her or am I rooting for these people to fall in love? And he is just absent enough that you're not like, oh, how nice. And again, that's part of the story breadcrumbs that they're laying out. But because we meet her and she works at a year-round Christmas tchotchke shop.
Yes.
Run by Michelle Yeoh, who goes by the
iconic
name Santa. Stunning.
And is hysterically funny in this.
So good in this. Who has the weirdest courtship with a German gentleman who gifts her kraut. Like, he's like, here's a Christmas tree made of sauerkraut. Like, honestly, that's a thing that happens. And so she has this very peculiar job. And, you know, you're like, oh, she's a real screw up. And then you get the very kind of rom-com energy of like, this girl's beautiful, but boy, is she clumsy. Doesn't that make her relatable?
And she's such a hot mess.
Right? And you see her like, she can't stay with this friend because she lit this on fire or whatever.
She's not answering her mom's phone calls. Oh.
Yeah. And then, but her whole shape, I was like, I don't particularly like you for the first 20 minutes of this movie.
Yeah. She does one thing in her sort of just her selfishness of not sort of paying attention and not doing the stuff that she's supposed to do that is so terrible. That I was like the whole time it happens and like you get the payoff of the awful thing that happened, like, you know, 10 minutes later. And I was just cringing the whole time. Like, no, she did that thing. She did it. And the movie.
Are you talking about with the sister?
No, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, I was talking about when she leaves the place unlocked.
Oh, yeah.
She leaves the Christmas store unlocked for the night and she just kind of walks off and ignores it. I'm like, and then she's off doing two or three other things. And the whole time I'm thinking, the store's unlocked, you know? And we're supposed to forgive her for all of this stuff. And I don't know that Emilia Clarke is the actress to make us warm to a character who is so aggressively a pain in the ass to so many people for so long in this film.
She's interesting because obviously I loved her in Game of Thrones, which I know you didn't watch, but I also adored, is it Me After You?
Yes.
I adored her in that.
Oh, God, I hated that movie.
I have problems with the movie itself, but I remember watching it, I think on a plane, and I had never seen her do anything other than Daenerys Targaryen. Mm. And I was like, oh, this actress has such brightness and such a like sweetness to her. How nice to see her use these different tones. So I think that she has possibility in this realm, and I think she's a likable enough actress to pull it off.
I think that was part of it for me because like when she was playing that grungy sort of asshole, I was like, oh, I like this. Like, this is fun. This is different than what I've seen before. But then, it's like when it became a little schmaltzy, I was like, I don't believe this as much as I should be.
I will say this. I think in talking about this movie, I figured out that I'm one of those people, like, you know those horror fanatics who will tell you, well, this movie isn't very good, but it's got some really good kills in it? That's how I am with Christmas movies. Like, I can tell you, you know, objectively speaking, yes, this movie has problems. This movie isn't as well-structured as it could be. I didn't love the central performance. But as a delivery system for, like, the Christmas stuff that I want in a movie, there's a lot of it. Like, I loved the kitschy store. I love the completely artificial London. Like, Dave's joke was it makes Love Actually look like Train Spotting. I mean, like, to the point where you have, like, a homeless shelter that is just wrapped in twinkle lights, you know? It is all so incredibly, like, picture postcard perfect. And of course, you're not supposed to buy a second of it, you know, but it's just as a kind of magical Christmas movie trope, it did give me that sense of sweep, you know.
I feel like where we are now, it would be nice to get into some of the spoilers.
Yeah, we need to.
Because they are so bonkers. So if you are like really just living a life,
if you
where
have a ticket for tomorrow night's show,
yes, you want to see Last Christmas with your mind fresh and no clue of what's going on, this is the time to maybe fast forward a bit because it gets weird. And we kind of knew it would get weird. And I need to give Mr. Alonso Duralde so much credit because I came into the office after seeing the trailer literally months ago and said, did anyone look at that trailer and think Henry Golding might be a ghost? And Alonso looked back and said, here's the thing. I think he's a ghost. And I think that, like the song says, he gave her his heart last year and then died. And anyway, he called it like nothing I've ever seen. Like, I honestly,
I never get these.
I got chills when you said it then. And then to watch it come true, it like meant so much.
What's hilarious is that Paul Feig gave some interview where he was sort of annoyed with people who, as he said, dissected the trailer like it was The Matrix or something. I'm like, I didn't it was in the middle of the room and I tripped on the carpet. Like, it's...
Well, maybe this year, to save him from tears, I should have given it to someone special.
Well, they talk about being special at some point in the movie, too. It's like, oh, God, stop it.
I think my thing was just, it was so obvious. And from the beginning of the movie, when you meet Henry Golding, I immediately knew, like, why is he twirling around not touching other people?
Yeah, why is no one else ever participating in their conversation?
No, and I feel like I spent more time looking to see if his footprints were making marks, because I knew it, and
amazing.
I was like, and that's the kind of freak I am.
I had guessed the ghost part as well, so I was looking for, oh, does he have corporeal form? Because they can touch, like she touches his hand, so I was looking for clues like that, and it was pretty obvious from the trailer, in the sense that I could tell his character was not grounded in the in the glossy reality that she was. And that's fine. There's a great history of that. But I don't think it came across as, like, it's meant to ultimately feel very romantic. And he has this line about, because he's given her his heart, just like the song says. And he says something, which is a great line, like, well, it was always going to be yours. And I was like, well, why? Were you guys supposed to meet? The movie that this reminded me of unexpectedly is another rom-com called Just Like Heaven, also titled after a song. And it's Reese Witherspoon, Mark Ruffalo.
God, yes.
And Reese Witherspoon plays this doctor who's killed at the beginning on her way to a date. And Mark Ruffalo.
She killed her, or is she in a coma?
Oh, you're right. She's in a coma, and Mark Ruffalo is renting her apartment,
right.
And she haunts him and whatever. And basically, at the end, you find out that she was hit on the way for a date between the two of them. So, like, the whole time, they were meant to be together.
I had a nickel for every time it happened to me.
And you got a story. She came out of that coma, and they did
end
up together.
What is the Minnie Driver movie? Isn't there a
Return
movie?
Return to Me?
She, like, gets the
heart
lady's
transplant.
Heart, and then the guy falls in love.
There's
David
a Christian,
and...
Christian Slater.
Yeah. Oh, it was originally called Baboon Heart, but they changed it to Untamed Heart.
Untamed Heart. I believe it was shot in Minneapolis.
Yes.
That was Bed of Roses.
Christian Slater, Marissa Tomei, and Rosie Perez. Yeah, there's a lot of transplant romances, apparently, I guess.
Which I'm sure everyone waiting for an organ is like, oh, this is romantic.
And strangely enough, Pedro Almodovar has not made one. You'd think he would. Like,
genuinely shocked.
Right, yeah.
He made The Skin I Live In.
That's
and yet
true. Close
not,
enough.
Listen, Skin... That's an organ.
You're right.
Or
largest
just
one
fixing
or something.
The skin.
I saw this coming like a million miles away, like from the first trailer. I was like, okay, this is what we're doing. And it is kind of a nuts move for a rom-com to do. So I kind of admire the chutzpah. I mean, this is basically The Sixth Sense, you know, where Emilia Clarke is the kid and Henry Golding is Bruce Willis, you know. But of course, I have to go back and look at The Sixth Sense and Fight Club to see if after they reveal their twists, if the director feels the need to go back and show you every single scene
that
confused you. Because Joker did it, and now this movie does, where it's like, yes,
where
we
they
get
show
it.
You this scene from the outside, and it's just them talking
here's
to themselves.
What really
it's
happened.
What I was dreading the entire time, because I was like, I really don't want to see Emilia Clarke replaying these scenes by herself, kissing nothing.
Right.
Oh, so awkward. And it's also like, give the audience a little respect. We get it. He said. Also, the minute she was headed towards that bench, I was like, I will give $1 million if his name is not on that bench.
Because they make such a point of there's a plaque on it. And I was like, that's going to be Henry Golding's name.
So this is my last thing, and it's so particular. But we saw that girl hook up with like three different dum-dums. And then Henry Beautiful Golding comes by, and she's like, no thanks, you're weird. Go away, you're weird. Like she does. And I was like, No. I saw the people you slept with yesterday. No,
sleeping with Henry Golding wouldn't be self-destructive, which is why she was not interested.
Oh, my God, Alonzo!
Here's my thing about the movie. So at the end, it's the big, beautiful finale, the music finale. It's great. But then she invited the realtor who was helping sell Henry Golding's apartment that she ran into by the end of the movie. She invited him to the show at the end.
Why not? She, she wanted the money for the shelter. Her heart grew three sizes. So before we give our final ranks, last week we had us all write down our guesses of what this film would be about. And since Iffy's not here, I'd like to read his. Also, because I'm dying, he basically covered all the bases. He has guessed he's dead or has cancer. He's an angel and she dies. She's been dead the whole time. awesomely, the first half of the first one was right. The rest are crazy, and I can't wait until Paul Feig makes those movies. So what is our final review of Last Christmas? We choose, are you going to screen it, stream it, or skip it? Alonzo.
I would say stream it. I think this is, you know, I think that we tend to watch Christmas movies in a different way than we do from other films. Again, I think for a lot of us, it is sort of a delivery system for like certain, you know, for like lighting and music and cheer and, you know, tales of redemption and that kind of thing. So like, you know, in a year when it's on HBO or whatever, have it on in the background while you're addressing Christmas cards or wrapping presents, and you'll be charmed by how it looks and by some of the performances, and, you know, it'll be this lovely little bauble that you can look at on your television.
Good, good. Matt, what about you?
I would say stream it, if not for only hearing Emma Thompson say the words lesbian pudding.
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, yes. I was going to add that as well. Yeah. I would like that to be my phone ring. Mm-hmm. Just lesbian pudding. Lesbian pudding. Oh, no, she's a weirder, like, lesbian pudding. Mm-hmm. This crazy accent.
Nailed it.
Yes, okay. I would say the same. I would be in the stream it category. As much as there's a messiness to it, and I have, like, all of these story nitpicking, I do think there's heart and beauty and great things to be playing in the background as you make your stew, you guys.
There you go.
Melt everything in that stew.
I will just say this, though. You know, if this movie does not do well theatrically, it gets that much harder for people to make theatrical Christmas movies.
Fair enough. Hear, hear. All right. We'll be right back after we hear from another show on Maximum Fun.
You wept as we crafted the tragic tale of Jar Jar, a Star Wars story.
Yeah. Dude, like, he forgives Darth Vader. Lisa still love you, Annie.
You gasped out loud at the shocking twists of Face Off 2, Faces Wild.
He takes his kid's face.
What?
We're writing an entire screenplay week by week on Storybricks Season 2, Heaven Heist. Hey folks, Freddie Wong here with some exciting news about Story Break, the Writer's Room podcast where three Hollywood professionals have 1 hour to spin cinematic gold. We're shaking up our format by turning Heaven Heist, one of our favorite ideas we've ever come up with on the show, into a full screenplay.
Heaven Heist is an action comedy about a crew of misfit gangsters robbing the Celestial Bank of Heaven. Think of Coco meets Point Break.
Join us as we write this crazy movie scene by scene and get an inside look at the screenwriting process on our podcast Story Break every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
All right, welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I am your host, Drea Clark. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Drea Clark. Matthew D'Ambrosio.
Oh my God, you are me now. But we can be that weird. I am you.
Mm-hmm.
You are me. We're a meme now.
My name's Drea. I love cats.
So true. All right, now it's time to answer a call from the Who Shot line. Casey, play that call.
Hi, this is Casey from Washington, D.C., and as we're getting into the holiday season, I was just wondering if you guys have any favorite holiday movies that aren't about Christmas. So if there are any films that center around Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or another holiday that you guys love, it would be great to know what those are. And also, if there are any Christmas movies about someone who maybe doesn't love Christmas and the happy ending of the movie doesn't depend on them coming around and learning to love it, that would be great too. But just so you know, this is in no way a dig at Christmas Daddy and the Christmas Minute, which I, of course, adore. I'm just curious and would love to hear your thoughts.
Well, thank you, Casey.
Oh, diplomatically handled, Casey.
I feel better now. You know, yeah, it's funny. There are not nearly enough Kwanzaa and Hanukkah movies. I have never seen a Kwanzaa movie. I don't know if they're surely someone's made one by now, but it has not entered into my radar. I do have a Hanukkah movie that I recommend, which is the very funny The Hebrew Hammer. This is it. Basically, Adam Goldberg is like the Jewish Shaft in this movie. He like wears a long leather coat. He drives a big 70s car. He's a total badass. And when Santa's evil son, played by Andy Dick, launches a plan that will destroy Hanukkah, he has to save Hanukkah with the help of Judy Greer.
Sure.
And it's very funny. And of course, none of this impresses the Hebrew Hammer's mother, who wish she would stop running around and just settle down and get married. And she's played by Nora Dunn. He's been promising a sequel for a while, and I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
One of my favorite lines from that movie is, I think Adam Goldberg says, "I like my women like I like my matzah unleavened." And I've always remembered it.
It's solid. It's a solid line.
Yeah. And I think Mario Van Peebles plays like the Kwanzaa defender as well. Like, it's a whole thing.
Honestly, the cast list you just said blew my mind. Yeah. I feel like you dreamt that movie.
You had me at
and
Nora
then
Dunn.
Matt backed you right? up. Oh, love Nora Dunn. Although the idea of her playing Adam Goldberg's mom, like... I guess. Ugh, I don't understand how time passes.
I've seen worse stretches.
That's fair. It's interesting, that question, because I was like, that's actually a great premise. The idea of the complexities that you can have from a story centered around Christmas, which is about someone who doesn't like Christmas, because not everyone does. Christmas yeah. is a really bummer time for a lot of people. A lot of people are not Christian. There's just a lot of things with there that's possibility, and I can't really think of a movie that addresses that other than like Bad Santa, where he remains indifferent to the spirit sure. of Christmas throughout.
I would turn you to the French, who yes. have made some very dark movies. A Christmas Tale, A Conte de Noël, from Arno Desplechin, is this great movie where Catherine Deneuve is sort of the matriarch of this big French family, and the kids are like, you know, Melville Poupeau and Mathieu Amalric. And,
nice.
And basically she has a disease and needs a bone marrow transplant. And traditionally, parents will give this kind of transplant to their children, but she's like, I brought you into this world. You owe me now. And so they're all gathering to see if anybody is the right type to give her the transplant, including Mathieu Amalric, who'd been basically like exiled from the family over this dispute that he'd had of business thing with the sister. Yeah, it is very like, I mean, it's not like evil, this movie, but it is not like warm and fuzzy. And it definitely, if you're cynical about Christmas, you will feel seen, I think, in that one. Another one that I love is a French film called La Bûche, which has it's three sisters. One is Charlotte Gainsbourg, one is Emmanuel Bayard, and their parents. And you know, the characters kind of run the gamut with the thoughts about Christmas, but a lot of it is sort of poking fun at like the excessive hype and materialism of the season. And the Charlotte Gainsbourg character says, I hate Christmas. I hate Christmas cake, which is the title, La Bûche, because it makes me puke.
Nice.
But she also asked about other holidays. And I mean, yeah. you know, I like there are a couple of Thanksgiving movies, obviously.
My favorite
like,
Thanksgiving movie is probably Home for the Holidays.
Oh, absolutely. So
which is what I thought of, because that movie, A, gay Robert Downey Jr.
Yep.
B, Holly Hunter being great.
Mm-hmm. Holly Hunter wearing the most Midwestern coat I've ever seen in my life.
Robert Downey Jr. dumping chicken juice all over his
turkey.
Angry sister.
Onto who is that actress? Cynthia Stevenson.
Yeah.
From The Player.
Oh, she's so good at it.
Yeah, and Geraldine Chaplin and Charles Durning, Claire Danes. It's a great ensemble.
Yeah, great movie.
And then also Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is a Thanksgiving movie.
For sure.
Those aren't pillows.
Exactly. Those are not pillows. I am a big fan of New Year's movies, and I would steadfastly say The Hudsucker Proxy is maybe my favorite New Year's movie.
You know, for kids.
You know, it's for kids. Thank you. You know it.
Love that movie.
That it's a Coen Brothers film. It's Tim Robbins in this manic man-child role. But one of the reasons I think it works as an interesting holiday is because, you know, normally New Year's stories, you have either the countdown or you have the next day of like, how is my life going to be different?
Mm.
And they have an actual, like a giant clock, a magical clock freezes as he, like, comes to terms with his life for New Year's. And I think
sets
it's such
in that
a
movie.
Cool one. Oh.
Beautiful sets.
Yeah, it's shaped so much like a classic film in terms of, like, quick banter. It's Jennifer Jason Leigh, right?
The reporter,
she plays, like, a reporter that goes undercover, and she's just a small-town girl that he falls in love with.
She's very, like, you know... Katharine Hepburn crossed with, like, you know, Rosalind Russell and His Girl Friday.
Oh, she's so good.
There's a fun French caper movie from the early 70s called Happy New Year that was remade in the late 80s with Peter Falk and Charles Durning, also called
Happy New Year. You're super French today.
Yeah, well, you know, they do the holidays better. There's a movie that I discovered in recent years from that apparently is like a I went to a screening in LA and everybody else in the theater was French because I guess it airs on French TV every year. And the title literally translates like Santa Claus is a shit. And it was remade as the terrible American comedy Mixed Nuts.
Oh, with Steve Martin?
Yes.
Yeah, not good.
But it's about like a group of people who work on a suicide hotline and on Christmas Eve.
Mixed Nuts has such a great cast, and it's really hard to watch.
It's unwatchable. I've tried several times to finish it. I can't get through it. And it's Nora Ephron.
Yeah.
Do you think also Home Alone in the first movie they go to France, is that a reference to how much the French hate Santa Claus?
Nice. Solid. All right. Well, that was a very good question. Thank you to Casey for calling in. Thanks to anyone else who's called in as well. And if you have a question for us, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664.
Be like Casey. Keep it short.
All right. Now it is time for the segment that fills everyone's heart with a warm and cozy feeling. It is the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. Our Christmas, oh my gosh, Matt, you've not experienced this yet in person.
So excited for this.
This is a rarefied era right now. Get ready for it. Our Christmas Zaddy, Alonzo Duralde, will quickly list in 60 seconds all of the Christmas movies seen just this past week.
Drea, what's the name of my book?
Oh my gosh, that's interesting that you bring that up because he has a book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
I do.
And it makes him the consummate authority in this.
Thank you so much.
So are you ready to count this down?
Oh yeah, I put a bunch of Netflix movies into my phone when I went to New Jersey. So I have a ton to talk about.
All right,
here. Let's do this.
Hit it.
Okay, so we got Holiday in the Wild, which is Kristen Davis going on safari and falling in love with Rob Lowe. The Christmas part is barely in it, but as a sort of unmarried woman veterinarian who does elephants, it actually kind of works. Christmas Survival, British comedy, doesn't really quite land, although Julia Richardson is fun to watch. Noel, big launch on Disney Plus. It's a great 60-minute TV special and a 90-minute feature film, but worth seeing for the charming performances, and it's quite lovely. Let It Snow, highlight of the week, Netflix YA movie based on the John Green novel. Kieran Shipka, a bunch of other cool people. Delightful. Loved it. Holiday for Heroes. People are raving about this being the best Hallmark movie of the year. It's no Operation Christmas, another Mark Lucas movie that I like better. Go check that one out. Blue Ridge Mountain Christmas. I love Rachel Lee Cook, but didn't work at all. Always and Forever Christmas. Yawn. Picture Perfect Christmas. Generic. Mistletoe Secret. Hallmark, please stop trying to make Kelly Pickler happen. And no more Richard Paul Evans adaptations. And then Rock and Roll Christmas on Up has more hard Canadian ooze than an entire season of Trailer Park Boys.
Oh, wow. My God. That's 1 week, man. He does these every week. He watches this. It's impressive. It truly
is.
That
is great.
Honestly, you had me at Mark Lucas. I won't lie.
I will say this for Always and Forever Christmas. I always like seeing Canadian Asian character actor Cardi Wong. And he gets a romance in this one, which is he doesn't always in the Hallmark movies. It's a Lifetime one. So, you know, a little bit.
All right. Hear, hear. Cheer, cheer.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
It's time to wander over to that section in your virtual video store and see what the staff wants you to see. Now, we can pick from any movie in theaters, streaming, what have you. Matt, our guest, start us off.
So for my pick, I'm going to go with Kobayashi's Kwaidan, which is a old Japanese horror movie. It's Technicolor. Four separate ghost stories, but all done in this very beautiful, like, Japanese style. All on sets, beautiful painted, like, backdrops. Very spooky, very unsettling. Very long, but it's gorgeous. It's
like
one of my favorite
movies.
What year
is that from?
I want to say it's 1968.
Listen, I'm not going to give you any demerits if you're wrong.
But it's on the Criterion,
okay.
Copy of it. But it's like Technicolor, gorgeous ghost stories.
This is a very exciting, bold choice for you.
Yeah.
Nice. Alonzo, what have you? Is it French?
It is not French. It is also Japanese, weirdly enough.
Oh, my God!
And we didn't even compare notes. There was an article this week about how DVD sales have dropped like 86% in 13 years, which I find really depressing because I love physical media, and I feel like streaming is a big screw-over because things just disappear, or they get pulled, or they decide to make you pay for them four different times. We've all been there. So I'm really trying to promote physical media. So I want to let everybody know that Shout Factory is distributing it. Studio Ghibli and G-Kids have been collaborating on these really gorgeous Blu-ray box sets. And these are like literal, like they're more square than sort of the oblong case. And, you know, they feature a soundtrack CD. They feature lavishly illustrated booklets. They've been going through title by title. And the one that's coming out this week is Spirited Away, which I think is one of the
beautiful.
Great anime films ever, and certainly one of the great films to come out of Studio Ghibli. So, you know, if you love this movie, and you should, then I think you would really want to own this really nice version of it with the music, with the booklet and all this kind of stuff. I think there's something great about having DVDs and Blu-rays on your shelf. You know, I think, look, if you're single, people are coming to your apartment, they're looking at what books are on your shelves, they're looking at what DVDs you own, and they're looking at, you know, your physical media is a way that people are judging you immediately. So put good stuff on the shelf, because otherwise they have no clue. I don't know what the kids are doing today with the MP3s and how you're supposed to guess if not if this is somebody you want to sleep with or not based on like what their candles scent. So I don't even know.
I do like nice candles, so
yeah. Well, sure, we all do.
But that's still not as good as the DVD.
Absolutely.
A nice perusal of their collection.
I do love also that you're wearing a Ghibli shirt right now, Alonzo.
Oh, I am. I totally forgot.
Very fitting for your
pick. Oh, wow. Look, I'm so on theme today.
So on theme. Sadly, I'm not on theme. My choice is neither French nor Japanese.
Oof.
Incidentally,
my
best friend is half French and half Japanese, which she calls Frappanese. So shout out to Mika Shizawa. My staff pick is a film that actually I wasn't there for that episode, but was talked about on this. Long Shot. It is finally available for VOD and rental. It's on iTunes. It's on Amazon. I actually think it might be on Prime for like 99 cents right now.
Sweet.
I think it's on Prime for free.
Ooh, even better. It's Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. Yep, her.
I think it's like Thrun, actually.
Theron, yeah.
You say Charlize, you know.
Charlize. And I loved this film. It made me so happy to watch. I don't know if enough people checked it out. It's a really, really satisfying romantic comedy, but has spark and intelligence. She plays one of my favorite and most interesting female characters in that genre in so long. And he is wonderful in it, and
yes.
I'm not always a Seth Rogen like boner haver, but I had a boner for him in this
one. I wish I could give out 18 Best Actress awards this year, because the lineup is staggering. Like, I'm getting into the point where I have to like do my Best of the Year lists and get ready to vote for LA Film Critics, and it's like, I mean, and you have to remind people about the movies that came out like in the first chunk of the year that weren't like hugely promoted. Like, hey, remember Gugu Mbatha-Raw and Fast Color and Mary Kay Place and Diane?
We'll do it Globe style, so you could at least get 10, and you can switch up, put comedy and musical
in
comedy,
one, musical and drama.
And drama in the other.
For sure.
One thing, last thing about Long Shot, it has one of my favorite digs at a person I've ever heard. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it has a very good dig about an actress.
You have to.
It's the Jennifer Aniston joke.
I don't remember the Jennifer Aniston.
It's a very good joke about Jennifer Aniston going
solid.
From TV to movies. That is
okay.
So
you can tell us.
I laughed out loud.
It's so good. All right, so we are now going to check out something from our 5-star reviews.
Ooh.
If you leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, we will both read it on air and be really grateful.
That helps
us find new people. This is from James Offbase. So not of Phil, but of Fred. James Offbase. As a former Wham Bam Pow listener, Max Fun had me auto-subscribe to this podcast from the get-go. From the first episodes with my man Ricky back in my ears to the new normal with Iffy, Dre, and Alonzo, I know each week I'm going to get insightful critique, perspectives that broaden my own thinking, a genuine conversation full of respect and camaraderie, and at least a few movies to add to my need-to-see list. A true must-listen.
Thanks, James.
A perfect review. Thank you.
Very nice.
Thanks, James. I think you sounded pretty on base.
No.
Base. Oh, boy.
Matt, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How can people find you in the world?
You can find me at the corner of Western and Hollywood, just walking back and forth. You can find me on Twitter.
Walking your cats.
Yeah, walking my cats. Find me on Twitter at Dr. Matt D'Ambrosio or Instagram at Matthew D'Ambrosio. You're going to see a lot of pictures of cats.
Pictures of cats and clever, snarky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet us at Who Shot You Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/group/Who Shot You Podcast, or send us an email at whoshotya@maximumfun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. This is a production of Maximum Fun.
It is.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.